Good morning, everybody. My name is Christy Dames. Welcome to the session today. We have a really cool session, I think, called Kill Your Mouse, just making sure you're in the right place. It's about kinetic computing going mainstream. We have four very interesting folks today. We have Lee Shoup of Cheskin, Kristen Alexander of Microsoft Surface, Brewster Kahle, well-known, Alexa, Waze, and a lot of other things, $100 laptop, and Kai Wong of Guitar Hero. And Guitar Hero was front page of the paper today, so that's kind of a cool thing, too. The way we're going to do it today, I'm going to introduce each panelist, and we're going to start off with a question. We'll do about 40 minutes or so of questions back and forth. We're going to leave about 15 to 20 minutes at the end for you all, Q&A, to ask anything you'd like to ask. Be a lot of interaction going on. We may even start that sooner if we need to. So with that, I'd like to introduce our first panelist today, who is Lee Shoup. He's the executive vice president at the innovation consulting firm Cheskin. He's in charge of the company's technology practice. He's a street futurist who helps spark client innovation through the application of foresight techniques and understanding of social and technological change and a love of people and culture, which combine to create a unique and informed perspective. And Lee, this morning I wanted to ask you, you're an expert in consumer insights, but in trends, people and culture, but a lot about trends, and as a futurist, trends. So I wanted to say, is there something new about people that we need to know that's driving this new kinetic computing, new touch computing?
I don't think there's anything really new about people. I think that what is happening is a lot of trends are converging to make natural interfaces start to happen right now. A lot of them y'all are already probably familiar with. Technology is getting a lot faster. Technology is getting smaller. So we have hard drives and our iPods and GPS units and whatnot. Broadband connectivity is starting to become ubiquitous. Computing is moving from the PC and the desktop model into the cloud. And as a result, computing's got to take some different forms to accommodate what people want to do. People are becoming more mobile. People are multitasking all the time. So the interface model that we had that's worked so well for so long, you know, sort of the metaphor of the typewriter and the mouse, or the keyboard and the mouse, has been great for working on a desk in an office. But as we get in our cars, as we become more mobile and we want to move more, those interfaces have a lot of limitations. So for those reasons, I think we're starting to see a lot more ways of interacting with computing, and computing taking a lot more diverse forms than we've seen it take previously. I think that makes it really, really interesting for what's going to happen next. I think Brian Eno said in the late 90s, famously, that there should be more Africa in computing. And I think that that's what we're about to see, a lot more movement and touch and involving all of our senses to interact with computing in ways that are much more natural and intuitive for us. I think that's really great news for technology companies. First, companies that have been making hardware are seeing the PC market get commodified, and so the role of design and innovation is becoming increasingly important. And second, as we look at the next billion computer users, we can't assume that everybody knows how to type or is even literate. So we need to move to more natural and intuitive interfaces to get more people access to computing.
Okay, next up is Kristen Alexander of Microsoft. Kristen is the group research manager for Microsoft Surface Computing, where she is responsible for research and planning for Microsoft Surface in the surface computing industry. Microsoft Surface is the first commercially available Surface computer from Microsoft that responds to multi-touch, multiple users, physical objects, and digital content. And Kristen, I wanted to ask you, last week Bill Gates was just everywhere talking about Windows 7 and said that Windows 7 would include a touch interface. Are you the one responsible for that?
No, not me personally. But I know that Microsoft Research has been working on a variety of touch technologies over the years, and I think it's evolved to now it's being productized. And I think the overwhelming response to Surface when it was publicly announced last May, within the first week, we had 2,000 responses from 50 different countries and 25 different industries. So clearly, I think when it was shown as something that could become a product, I think people saw the vision for what it could do to change their businesses and communities and everyday life. So I think it was just, it's been an overwhelming response to it, the D conference. So.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Next, we have Brewster Kahle. And Brewster has built technologies, companies, and institutions to advance the goal of universal access to all knowledge, including Waze and Alexa, which were acquired by AOL and Amazon, respectively. He currently oversees the nonprofit Internet Archive as founder and digital librarian, which is now one of the largest digital archives in the world. He's a huge proponent of the $100 laptop, and he's a huge proponent of alternative approaches to almost everything. So, Brewster, I wanted to ask you, when we had spoken a couple of weeks ago about this panel, you had mentioned we're not going to call these things computers anymore. So we're talking about touch, but we're not going to call them computers anymore. Well, what will we call them, and what will they look like?
Oh, I think we'll call them phones and camcorders and refrigerators and doorknobs. And they're just starting to grow computer components, and they're starting to grow user interfaces and little screens on them. And thank God we won't have to necessarily just be sitting there like this for most of our day. So we're seeing, you know, the progress of computers being sort of introduced into everything, networking starting to be introduced to everything, and things are starting to come with little screens, whether they're your car or whatever. They seem to be mostly computer at this point. So how that's going to evolve, I think, is going to be depend on what we're all doing with them, and also both as corporations and as individuals. And there's an open versus closed thing that I think we'll see play out in this realm of appliances as well.
Thank you, Brewster. And then last but not least, we have Kai Huang. And Kai is the co-founder of Red Octane and has been the president and CEO since 1999. Publishers of the popular Guitar Hero franchise, Red Octane was acquired by Activision in June 2006. Prior to Red Octane, Mr. Huang was co-founder and CEO of Adux Software, a software company developing solutions for the server appliance market. So, Kai, I wanted to ask you, what's behind the phenomenal success of these new kinetic games, such as Guitar Hero? And is it more about the genre, or is it more about the controller and the way you interact with the game?
Yeah, Christy, that's a great question. So, you know, what's been behind the success of Guitar Hero? Well, first question I almost always get is, did you know that it would become this successful? And my answer is, no way, I had no clue, because if I did, I wouldn't have sold my company. but, you know, it's become a success well beyond what we imagined when we started it. And I think one of the key reasons, there's several reasons for the success of these types of games. I think one of the key reasons is accessibility. When we started with the game and the concept behind Guitar Hero, we really wanted to make a game that was very accessible, that anybody could pick it up, whether you're 5 to 55, man or woman, everybody would enjoy playing the game. And that was a huge, huge aspect of creating this game. And then the second thing I think that has made Guitar Hero such a big phenomenon is the social aspect of it, which is something else that we started off, you know, with the concept that we wanted to create a very social game. The New York Times calls Guitar Hero the new karaoke night. You know, it's replacing karaoke at bars across the country. And that's just a great sign that, you know, people really enjoy playing this. 40% of the people who play Guitar Hero are female, which is very atypical of your traditional game. So it's become a very social product, and it's something that we set out to do from the beginning. So I think those are a couple of the big reasons why Guitar Hero has become such a big phenomenon. That and such a fun game to play.
Yeah. So, Lee, I'm going to shoot back over to you for a second. And you had, we have Surface, we have iPhone, we have Wii. What are we learning from an insights perspective about people from these new kinds of interfaces?
I think we're learning that people want to interact with computing in new and more intuitive ways. And I think, you know, Guitar Hero is a great example. The Wii is a great example of taking a market that was, you know, fairly closed, you know, gaming being mostly young males. And by having smart interfaces and more accessible interfaces, opening those markets up where they're much bigger now and more accessible. And, you know, the traditional gaming companies are looking at Guitar Hero and Wii going, wow, you know, we need to do that. And looking at the size and the diversity of the market. So I think there's huge opportunities by tuning into different interfaces for people.
And Kristen, can you just tell us exactly what is Surface and just a little history about how did Microsoft Surface emerge at Microsoft?
Well, over the last probably 6 years, it was something that the Microsoft Research Division as well as the Hardware Division collaborated on. And it just basically, I think they saw this vision for merging the virtual and physical worlds. And I think that just the point about accessibility is a really important one, and the social piece. I think that's where it's sort of different from, you know, an iPhone. It's because the Surface has a large display and a horizontal form factor. Right now it's in a table form factor, and that really affords that sort of face-to-face communication and physical proximity and interaction. And the multi-user aspect of it means because it has multi-touch, multiple people can be using it at the same time. And so it it brings multi-touch into multi-user, which is something that's sort of unique. But essentially, at a very high level from a technical perspective, it is a vision-based system. So it's not capacitive. It actually has cameras that actually see the input from your hand. So it's actually capturing that. And through rear projection technology, it's reflecting that back up to the Surface. So it's a vision system layer on top of Windows Vista. And that's what allows that interaction to happen.
We've worked a fair amount with the Surface team. And one of the really fun things is when people see the Surface and they actually get to play with it, you really see people just go, wow. And they get the sense of play and they light up, you know, not like what you would do with a keyboard and a mouse. But, you know, it really brings in the play and the, like, the little kid in us where it's like, wow, I can touch stuff and I can move it around. And it really changes and puts joy into the act of interacting with this computing. And it's just really fun to see that.
And like when you it moves, you know, you can move a virtual photo in the same way that you would a physical photo. And so that's where I think people can just walk up and there's no learning curve for them. So it's exciting.
Yeah, that's a great point about the no learning curve, right? I mean, mm-hmm. we see the same thing with Guitar Hero. When we set out to make that game, you know, video game controllers today are very complex, right? You get these hand controllers that have 18 buttons on them, and people pick it up, and they really don't know what to do with it. You know, I always like to say that a game like Tetris, which is so simple and so universal, and everybody loves to play Tetris, right? But you put somebody who isn't a core gamer or in that core gamer demographic of 14 to 24-year-old males, and you make them play Tetris with an 18-button game controller, and all of a sudden, it's no fun anymore. It's different, right? And with Guitar Hero, we really focused on how do you simplify that interface, that physical interface that that person's going to deal with, so that it becomes very simple. You know exactly what it is, right? If you see somebody standing there with a guitar in their hand, you know exactly what they're trying to do. You know, it's a game, you know, it's not a real guitar, but you know what they're trying to do. And it becomes very, very intuitive. And that's how you can really draw people in.
Yeah, I think simplicity is key. I mean, I think the big design challenge now is taking increasingly complex computing experiences into really simple and intuitive interfaces. And that's just really hard. But when it works, it's great.
So I've read this natural user interface. So the NUI, we have the new NUI instead of the GUI. So have we gone from unnatural interfaces to now natural? How did we get this progression from the complex to now the simple? Anyone?
I think that people today have increasingly less time to learn new interfaces. And so I think, you know, when somebody buys a digital camera, they don't want to spend their whole day going through a manual reading how to use the camera. They want to take pictures. So, I mean, I think that that people are drawn to things where there is that level of simplicity that allows them to just jump right into the experience that they're wanting to have instead of taking the time to have to become experts on technology. So I think people are becoming less willing to do that when they see other alternatives.
Yeah, you know, and I think that's a problem that partially stems from the companies that create these products, right? Mm-hmm. It's very, very easy if you're trying to sell the next version of whatever product you're making, to just add one more feature or add 10 more features. In fact, that's kind of what you have to do if you want to keep selling more product, right? So as technology advances, you know, and specifically, again, coming back to the game controller concept, you have a controller with 18 buttons and you want to sell your next version, what do? Well, the simple thing is to add a few more buttons on there and, you know, allow a few more features. The really difficult thing is to simplify that back down and create something that becomes, you know, very accessible. I think Nintendo has done that with the Wii product, which they've done an amazing job of taking very complex technology and bringing it back to where everybody has an opportunity to you know, kind of go back to playing games again. You look at what Apple has done, you know, with the iPod and the huge success that they've had. They weren't the first ones to create an MP3 player, but, you know, they really knew how to perfect that physical interface, bring it back, make it very accessible for people.
Yeah, well, I think Kai's pointed out a really interesting problem in software development, and that's feature creep. It's so easy for everything just to get bigger and bigger and bigger and more bloated. And I find myself using new products now, you know, saying I would pay more money for them to take features out. And so I'm wondering if we ever hit a place where people say, you know, please let the next version be, you know, half the code base of the one I just had and half the features. Just give me the features that I want and get rid of everything else. So wouldn't that be interesting in a world where people pay for upgrades to have less features?
Brewster, this brings up an interesting point because we talk about the device and we talk about intuitive interfaces. And Brewster, I've heard you say before that you love systems that can be hacked. Yeah. And that you have a problem right now because the U.S. is losing its ability to hack.
Oh, yeah.
So why is that important? Do we still need hackable devices?
Oh, the things that we sort of take for granted now, some of the great stuff that's gone on, we're all very hackable technologies. You take the personal computer, one of Microsoft's earliest programs was a basic compiler, mm-hmm. right? It was basically all about using this kind of generic thing for new and different stuff. And it's become harder and harder to program Windows machines. And it's become really toxic to try to program an Apple machine. I mean, if you start getting successful, they'll stomp you. And so as a platform, it's not something you want to do unless you're an enormous company or you want to get acquired. So there have been other things like the internet, which was actually a whole big battle about hackability versus mm-hmm. control. There was the 1980s, the Bell companies versus the ARPANET. And the ARPANET was hackable. And we could come up with all sorts of cool new things, such as the World Wide Web. And so the 1990s was all about AOL, controlled, closed garden world, versus, you know, a wacky open world that was exciting and generated billions of dollars and mm-hmm. stuff. And this decade, we seem to be really battling out the commons. Who owns the commons? The YouTubes and the, is it iPod? Is it going to be iTunes controlling all music distribution, such that if you don't work at Apple, sorry. Or is it going to be kind of interesting and all sorts of new and different things? And the impact, I think, on this discussion is what's happening in the devices area. As we're moving into devices and appliances, is it going to be a one winner per area, or is it going to be something you can play with and go and build on? And the Surface thing, I think, is a good step. Where I worry about the cell phones. We just heard that Kleiner Perkins and Apple had to try to figure out how to get $100 million to try to get people to develop for the iPhone because it's such a closed garden kind of world. They'll have to pay people basically to, you know, please, please, please develop for this. That wasn't how the World Wide Web came about. It was a groundswell. So I'm interested in things that are playable. And one of the interesting thing I think you might want to really consider is the $100 laptop. This doesn't come from my organization. I work in the back end world of we've got movies and music and books and people that want to play with this stuff in new and different ways. And we're feeling really locked out of everything except the web. And if we want to get to devices, I think we're going to have to start playing with open platforms. So I brought one of them. This is an early beta of it. And we did a little dopey interface to one of our books on it. And I'll pass it around. And it's if you use the little round button on the top and rock it back and forth, up and down, You can page through this thing. And you can see that this is a 200 dot per inch screen. It's got a camera, speakers, wireless, open operating system. It is a device that you might want to think about. How do you play with this? Is this the next digital picture frame that has sort of a video component to it? Or, you know, can you connect from one place to another? But this is cheap, and it's got all the components to play with it. And so if you want to play device land, this kind of thing might work. And I'm hoping that other organizations start to produce other things. You know, I compare it to this, the Sony Reader, which, you know, sort of begat the Kindle. And it came with so much digital rights management that who can play? You know, what can you do with this thing? And what's happening with their market? Well, nobody's buying them. And why? It's not open. To be successful, I think, is going to be open. And what we need in this appliance area is people that are willing to play. And so that's my my pitch for both being successful in the business world and societally. We're going to need things without mice that are hackable. And this is the one of the only devices I've seen right now. Surface has got some good possibilities. But how do we make these things so we can play?
So what's driving all of this? I mean, is the driver people? Is it people? Are people wanting this? Are they saying we have to have this? Or again, is this being driven at people? What's going on with it? Where's this coming from, this new intuitive connection?
Well, from my perspective, you know, from an interactive entertainment space, I think it's not being driven by the people and the consumers asking for it. It's being driven by, you know, companies that are actively taking a look at this space and saying, wow, we could really do something different and create a very new and unique experience for, you know, gamers out there. As an example, you know, some of the top video games selling on the consoles, the PlayStations, the Xboxes, and the Nintendos will sell anywhere between 15 to 18 million units over the course of the life of a game. The really, really top games. A product like Guitar Hero has sold over 15 million units in just a couple of years. But really, it wasn't something that people were asking for. You know, it wasn't something that they knew that they necessarily wanted. At least, you know, people, there wasn't a groundswell. I mean, some people knew they wanted it, but, you know, it wasn't millions and millions of people asking. I think it's companies trying to figure out, or people trying to figure out, you know, what is it that they want? What are they looking for? How do you create something that's new, that's different, that they haven't experienced before? Nintendo, again, has just done a fantastic job of seeing that need, a need that consumers didn't even know they wanted, and addressing that.
I think for me, I look at the explosion of just digital content that people have, whether it's movies or photos or music. And I think that the mouse and the keyboard are just not a very good way of interacting with volumes and volumes and volumes of digital content. So I think that the way in which you interact with that information needed to evolve away from the mouse and the keyboard and allow people to manage and manipulate and interact with this content in a more natural, intuitive, and actually more efficient way. So that's kind of what I've seen. If people have all this digital content and a keyboard and a mouse isn't the optimal way to manage all that information, I think that a new interface was required. After 20 years, we needed a new way. So,
I think people are bored with sitting and typing in a keyboard. It's like, I'm a hyperactive child. I hate sitting in front of the keyboard all day. You know, I want to be get up and move around and have different ways of interacting. We're seeing people with repetitive stress syndrome and all the stuff just from doing this all day. So let's do something different.
And it can be quite isolating to just be yourself in front of a small computer screen and trying to share pictures or photos or even just on your little camera with a little screen. I think it's very difficult to share those with other people. It's just kind of socially uncomfortable. If you've ever had multiple people around a PC trying to focus, I think that's the benefit for Surface of having such a large display, that you can be actually passing photos to someone that's across from you and interacting with them as you would in the real world.
But haven't we really raised the bar towards getting something out there? With the PC applications in the 80s, the web applications in the 90s, in terms of, you know, putting up a website, a couple people could do something and get something out there that people would use. I'm worried that we're made a world that if we're going to shift away from the PC, we've made it very hard. I just want to ask a question. How hard was it to take this idea and get it to market, of building a device and getting it through manufacturing? Did you have to sell your company to be able to get a device out there?
Yeah, you know, it was incredibly challenging to do a product like this, right? When you're sort of cutting new ground, I'll tell you at the beginning when we were kind of on the road down this concept in 2005, which was a few months before we launched Guitar Hero. You know, we faced just insurmountable hurdles at the time, right? Luckily, we were kind of new to the gaming world. So my brother and I started the company in 99, and we weren't in video games before. But really, I think that's what helped us, right? We had no idea what you could or couldn't do. But what people were telling us was that, first of all, you were making games in the music space, which, you know, previously no games had really succeeded in the music gaming category. You were making a peripheral-based video game, which, you know, who has made a successful peripheral-based video game, right? Dedicated peripheral. You are a publisher. We were a really small company. We're still really small at the time. We're about 50 people within our business unit now that we're part of Activision. But we were about 40 people at the time when we started, you know, on the Guitar Hero project as a publisher. And this is a time in 2005 when the publishing industry was consolidating. And so the big were getting bigger and everybody else was going away. We had a big package that we had to get on the shelf. Guitar Hero comes in a box this big, right? Maybe even a little bit bigger. And for retailers, they don't want to carry something so big. You know, they're telling us, no, we can't carry that. It's too big. And then we were introducing a product with a price point that was much higher than your typical game. Games now are $59. We were introducing our product at $100. So just having to overcome all of those barriers, you know, now that I think about it, I'm surprised we're here, right? But it was just incredible, all those barriers that we had to overcome.
It can be really helpful having beginner's mind, knowing the obstacles that everybody perceives are in front of you.
Yeah, and I think that's really how you have to do it, right? If you're really out to change a paradigm and change the way you know, people traditionally think about things, you really have to start from scratch. And I think that's kind of what allowed us to succeed with our products, is that we just started from scratch. We didn't know what would work or what wouldn't work. We just said, we think this will work, we believe in it, and we're going to do it.
So we've been talking a lot about touch, but voice recognition was the long ago promised panacea, and that kind of came and went, and now we have this touch thing, and is that going to come and go? And then Emotive just announced this new psychoneuro technology where you just put a little headset on and use your eyes to be able to play a game, for what that could mean for developers anywhere, paraplegics. I mean, all of a sudden it changes landscapes everywhere. Anybody have any thoughts on that?
I think we may actually see, let me go a little retro on you. When credit cards were going to take over the world, we got ATM sort of resurge and people used cash, at least for a while longer. I've been seeing a lot of people wanting to print and bind books. It may seem a little retro, but the idea of using our computer technology, but the end device that people might actually use might actually look more like this for a lot of things, but they might be delivered in a very different way. They might be much more custom. They might be built in some on-demand, right there approach. And maybe we'll see these touch things replace all things such as books, but I think we may see a resurgence in some of the physical forms, but where there's a lot of computer technology just behind it. The newspaper realm, which was going to go away for a long time, and it's now sort of in that seemingly death row, they basically replaced the whole inside of the newspaper business with electronics, and then they turned it into paper just on that last little bit. We may see some more building blocks. Computer-based manufacturing, computer-based building blocks, but the end product might end up being books, CDs, other types of things for a while longer than you'd imagine. And that doesn't mean that there's not opportunities for people wanting to go and make and play in those realms. In fact, there's often a lower barrier than doing the whole new platform, which takes sometimes large corporations to be able to pull off. Mm-hmm.
So, Brewster, do you think that's more of a backlash of just sort of technology's gotten too far ahead and people are kind of coming back to the old way? Or do you think that we really are going to go back? Because I hear some things about, you know, people, particularly in the VC community who are investing in new technologies, that this will be the last generation where people own physical media, you know, whether it's a book. The whole generation now of kids that are growing up are used to just downloading stuff on, you know, iTunes or downloading movies and music or, you know, whatever books onto a Kindle or, you know, the Sony device. Do you think it's sort of a backlash or do you think that we are actually going to move toward that?
No, I think it's a backlash. I think it's where we're trying some of these things out. And the reason why we are is actually economic.
Yeah.
The reason why we're staying with these building blocks is because they're easier to experiment with. These new electronic platforms, I think, are just very, very expensive. And we don't have toys. We don't have an ability to play. If we had more of an ability to play, I think we'd move much more quickly. If different people could make their own home entertainment system by going and plugging together and being kind of open like the PC was, I think we'd see a lot more evolution, especially in this country, because we've lost our ability to manufacture much. We really have to go offshore to do that. And the threshold there is high. I think it's a backlash. We will be the last generation. I think they are, in fact, yeah. Right.
So which would make it more interesting that once technology and content and information goes even more digital or goes completely digital, that these interfaces, you know, new interfaces that we're talking about and discussing become that much more important, right? Books, you know, you can touch and you can feel and you can, you know, put on a shelf and it's very accessible. But once you have 1,000 books in this,
right,
how do you access it and what's the easy way to do that and convenient, intuitive way? It really does make, you know, the Surface concept and those kinds of things much more critical.
Well, and Surface on, you know, Surface is a, we talk about social media. Surface is a collective. It's a group. It can be this group. It can be an individual experience, but mm-hmm. it's a group experience. Mm-hmm. So what are the collective implications of going beyond a single user device to what you talk about, the multi-touch points kind of device?
I think it opens up the opportunity to collaborate and share in a much more easy and convenient way when you're, you know, in close proximity. And I think that because of the ease of use, I think it also, similar to the Guitar Hero, I mean, I think it's ease of use for all ages and skill levels. So sometimes we talk about different kinds of games, like, say, Scrabble or something, that maybe a parent and a child could play together and it could do some dynamic leveling or something. So they're playing the same game, but the power of computing allows them to play at their level. So I think they're just having the power of the computer there and being able to share all kinds of different digital information and content that's personalized and customizable, I think is pretty compelling.
And why do you love this so much? I mean, you've worked at Fisher-Price. I mean, you have a really brilliant career and now you're here. And is there a personal driver with this for you?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, you were asking about different input modalities for people that have different disabilities and that sort of thing. I think I'm excited by opening up the power of technology and computing to a greater number of people, and also having it be optimized for different kinds of people, different kinds of tasks and activities. The more we expand the different input modalities, the more people that I think will be able to really leverage the power of technology that exists today. That in the same way, I think, we talked about kind of DOS to GUI. I mean, that opened up computing for such a large number of people that didn't want to type lines of code. And so I see this next evolution as it's doing that same thing. And I think also I talked about efficiency. When Surface allows for wireless device synchronization, you know, you can put down your music player and you know, my mom could put down her phone and I could flick certain, you know, just with a flick of a finger, not plugging anything in, to share that content with her. And then she can take it with her photos or whatever. I think that that's something that my mom can understand. You know what I mean? It's like you're taking this song or photo and you're moving it over to my device and now I have it with me instead of, you know, Bluetooth sessions. And mm-hmm. I mean, the technology exists today. It's just cumbersome and confusing for people. So I'm personally excited about bringing new opportunities for people to really leverage the technology that exists today that's just not designed well or cumbersome. So,
And Lee, so what are the collective implications as a futurist? What do you see from going to this single user experience to this multi-touch point experience?
Well, I think humans are really social animals. I mean, a lot of the experiences that we have are the most powerful for us around music and film and experiences that we have collectively with other people. And so I think it's natural that computing would move that way. And I think that we'll see a whole variety of natural interfaces, not just touch, but we'll see voice recognition get better. You know, who knows what other senses will start to be involved, where computing will be a lot more the way that we experience the quote-unquote real world, where we're just using all of our senses and using them in combination to interact with computing.
Well, and Rooster?
I posed to some designers, and I'll pose it to you guys too. If you were to try to design a room that it's going to be in a mall, it's going to be in every mall, in every school, every retirement home, hospital, that's going to be the information portal room. I'll call it a library. But basically the idea is you walk into this room and you can have access to anything you want, any information you want, books, music, video, you know, whatever. How would you design this room, right? How do we take the concept of the information portal, the library in that sort of 18th century sense of library, and move it forward? And what they came up with was touch walls, these sort of multi-touch walls where you get to go and interact with other people around a surface. You're standing up. You're not looking down. You're standing up, and you're doing kind of that Jeff Hahn thing or the Minority Report thing, yeah. Where you're basically going and pulling resources from other places. Other people can help you out without it being a big sort of logging into somebody else's computer thing. And that kind of idea excited me, because I think we've defined the desktop as 12 inches diagonal, which is a really weird thing, right? A desktop is this big. And the idea of standing up and playing is something that I think is a lot more interesting. Can we make multi-touch screens that are that big, inexpensive? I believe we can. It's the projection technology. It's cameras that are in just about everything. And it's computers that are pretty darn fast. You have to actually make it work. But that type of what would you do to a room or your room or your office or your home office that would make it so that it's not a one of these experiences, but a one of these experiences? And then how do we do backfill all of the networking, the information technologies required to get there? But I think we have an opportunity here. It's take your idea and blow it out, or make a multi-user, multi-environment that's computer enhanced, that's multi-people enhanced. One thing we get to play with now is the millions of people, other people that are on the net, not just your friends, but all the other people. And these are the building blocks that will make some of the head turners in 10 years from now.
That's actually why we called it Surface and not Table, because its first iteration really is in this horizontal form factor that is a table. But the long-term vision for this is to have it be horizontal, vertical, large, you know, of all different sizes, whatever that makes sense for that context of use. So that's definitely our longer-term roadmap, is thin form factors that can be 70 feet,
right.
You know, that people can, that might make sense in an enterprise space. If you have a large interactive wall where you're manipulating slides for a PowerPoint, or you're collaborating at a distance and you're both seeing the same thing. So definitely that is the future of where we see this going.
Go, go, go.
Well, that brings up something really good, because for the entrepreneurs out here, the developers, for the next Guitar Hero folk in the audience, from all of you, what would you say to folks about what to think about, what to work with, how to approach this new paradigm that's happening?
Okay. Yeah, you know, I would say that it comes back to something which I started with, which is accessibility. Mm-hmm. You know, technology is getting so much further than, you know, most of us can really comprehend or even want. I mean, there's, you know, God knows how many features on my cell phone, and the only thing I use it for is, you know, dial, talk, and, you know, you can do a lot of things with it. But unless they're accessible and people are comfortable using it, then it really doesn't matter what you have, you know, what kind of features you have or what's on there, right? So, as you know, I would say that as you think about, you know, the new trends and where we're going, you know, something like the gaming space, for example, you know, we think about accessibility and how do you even take some of the concepts that are already out there and just make it much more accessible so that everybody can have access to it and enjoy it.
I think another way that we think about accessibility, it's in a lot of different ways, but also when you turn it into a form factor that can fit aesthetically into places where PCs didn't fit before, such as, you know, a hotel lobby or some kind of retail environment, or even home. If you had this in the family room of your home, certainly people don't necessarily want a PC in their family room. But if this was aesthetically integrated into the environment, I think that's exciting to me, that we're able to put the power of computing into places where it just didn't fit before.
My recommendation would be put a computer in a place it doesn't fit before. And start to play with it. I had a little tussle with my wife about going and putting a computer into the dining room to do a slideshow, you know, basically the digital picture frame thing, but it was 10 years ago. And her concern was wires. Really didn't want the wires in these environments. So I had to do everything I could to try to hide it. But the cool thing about it was a computer that I could play with, and we could try out a bunch of different things. And it's sort of canonicalized into the digital picture frame now, and it's pretty generic. But go and play with something new. Go and put a projector in your living room and run it off of a computer and try to hide the wires. But use the open technologies that we have right now to experiment with what's going to come next. Otherwise, you're just going to be constrained to what it is the device was that was sold to you to do. And you guys are going to be inventing the next generation of all of this stuff. So, okay, so it's got a few extra wires. But use the open appliances. Try some things out. Blow some things out. Don't get just use the bigger, clunkier one for now. Realizing that it's going to be able to get smaller, and invent what it is we should be carrying around. Because what we're carrying around now isn't what we should be carrying around, but you guys should be designing the next generation, not just the research labs of the big corps.
Amen. I'd say, amen, Brewster. I'd say it's really about understanding people and what they want to do and making the things that they want to do so much easier and so much more intuitive than they are now. We use a lot of ethnographic approaches to watch what people are doing and just see where people get stuck. And of course, the devilish thing is that we have all these weird workarounds in our lives when we interact with technology that we're not even conscious of. We just develop the workarounds and they become invisible to us. And I think that's really constraining both in how we look at people and how we look at design and the possibilities of technology. So I think trying to get rid of that for people that are our future customers, trying to get rid of that for ourselves as designers, so that much like Kai did, you know, having beginner's mind and not even knowing what the limitations are, but having the world be completely open as you think about designing, you know, new experiences for people. I think those are the things that could make technology so much better than it is today and give us stuff that's so much less kludgy than it is today. And you know, I think we've all had the experiences of explaining to parents or technology-averse friends, you know, you get these questions like, how do I turn off the PC? Well, you go to the start menu, of course, and it's time to just move beyond that world and make things just stupid simple and so easy to use that we don't even have to think about it.
Well, it's funny too, because on that note, on the front page of the Austin paper today, there's a picture of a San Francisco band called the Guitar Zeros, and they took their Guitar Hero instruments to make real music. So they reinvented their Guitar Hero to make music.
It's pretty incredible, right? So, you know, you take, again, you look at creative things like this that people are doing. You know, they took an interface that we created, which, you know, we thought was quite simple and accessible. And they're now using it for something completely, you know, different that we never thought that people would want to do. They're making real music out of it. We're trying to, you know, make people pretend like they're rock stars. And these guys are taking our products and making them, you know, into real rock stars. So it's this kind of creative thought that is really interesting, that people are kind of thinking outside the box and, you know, just doing really creative things with the products that are out there.
You've been hacked.
Yeah, we've been hacked.
I think it's the unintended uses of technology that are the most fascinating, though. I mean, there's quotes, I forgot who said it, one of the early telephone guys, the telephone was envisioned as a broadcast device that would sit in your living room. And there's a quote from one of the major telco honcho guys saying, well, nobody will ever want to do anything stupid like talk to each other with this thing, you know, and look where we are now. So I think it's being really open to all the weird ways that people want to use technology and all the stuff that we haven't thought of, and allowing ourselves to be surprised and fascinated and change direction and accommodate that.
Are there any questions from the audience? We got a microphone right there. Please step up. Yeah.
Hi, guys. Thanks for the really entertaining discussion so far. And I wanted to get back to Brewster's discussion about hacking, and I thought it was a little pessimistic to hold up the iPhone or whatever, and you know, being unable to sort of hack apart something like jailbreaking and then have it getting into an arms race with Apple. Versus, I wanted to point out a few examples, a couple inspired by Mr. Wong. There's actually an open source Python product called Frets on Fire. Someone figured out that you can pick up your keyboard and use the F keys, and it's 90% as fun. And my classmate and I made a jug band game called Jug Hero, where we bought some whiskey jugs. We bought an Arduino board and we learned processing in Java. And I just wanted to ask you guys to talk about you know, the distinction between hacking a part, which is getting harder and is easy to sort of lock people out with the culture now, versus hacking together. And the creativity that the technologies that you guys present, inspiring us to sort of like pull things from our environment, like Johnny Lee Chung taking his Wiimote and actually making a multi-touch whiteboard. And if you guys haven't seen that YouTube video, you guys should type in Johnny Lee Chung. And so can you guys talk about that distinction of a new form of creativity where we're actually hacking things together versus trying to break open the closed boxes?
Anybody? Do it, right? It's what makes these things exciting and interesting is putting things together in new and different ways, not feeling like you're having to violate terms of service to be able to get there. I mean, okay, so you blow a warranty, but who cares about that? But don't make it so, you know, your door isn't going to get kicked down by somebody. And the building blocks we get to play, we have a lot of music and movies and fun things that you can play with now. And put together in new and different ways. And we've made an environment that does feel a little, I don't know, threatened. We need a little bit more slack, you know, just in general. Just sort of, let's play for a little while. And, you know, if it becomes a big business, then we start to do a deal with somebody to do Jug Band Hero, right? You know, but don't go and say, hey, that was my trademark, sorry. Right? You can't do that. And so I like your distinction of hacking apart and hacking together. Let's build more hack togetherable things.
Yeah, that's good. And I was going to say, you know, at Red Octane, you know, we love seeing that kind of innovation. I would say that our legal department maybe has a different view.
There's lawyers waiting for you outside.
But you know, we love seeing that innovation because it spurs creativity, right? And you see all the creative things that people are doing, the Frets on Fire, you know, the Jug Hero. We've seen people make platforming games using our guitar controller. So platforming games are like Mario Brothers, you know, side scrolling, which you think, why the heck would I be using a guitar for this type of game? You really wouldn't, but it's fun, you know, and people do some really creative things. And what I like about that is that, you know, certainly there's an area where it potentially crosses into legal aspects of it, you know, which which might be some issues. But at the same time, that spurs innovation, not just for the rest of the community, but for us as well, because some of those ideas do come back. And believe it or not, we do see everything that happens out there and all the creative things that are happening. And you know what? You know, just like people are playing off of our ideas, we're playing off of those ideas as well. So I think, you know, it's that type of thing that spurs innovation.
I have a question about cost. You know, LCDs are still more expensive than plasmas, and I think flash memory is still way more expensive than traditional hard disk. It's taken a really long time for these technologies, I think, to become mainstream because they're just simply more expensive and that cost doesn't go down quick enough. What trends do you see? And, I love the idea of the Minority Report and browsing through my library like that, but I'm not going to spend $50,000 to have that experience when I could put books on my wall. So what trends do you see in cost and really getting down to something that the common person can afford, especially in continents like Africa and Southeast Asia and places that can't afford to buy a $600 iPhone?
Getting cheap out there. I like the Xerox PARC idea. If you want to know what the future holds, just pay too much for your thing, right? If you want to basically buy 10 times more hard drive space, if you want to just see what 5 years from now is going to look like, it'll be a little bit big, a little bit clunky. You have to sort of imagine your way through it. But if you want to experience the future, just spend too much. Because we're still on this Moore's Law thing, which I think is just tremendous. Who would have thought that they'd really need a 1 terabyte hard drive, right? That they'd spend the billions of dollars to do it. But they did, and it's fantastic. The LCDs are dropping in price. I have to see more CRTs thrown away at this point than in use. So I don't know. It seems to be going in generally the right area, except for network bandwidth. The biggest problem we've got in this country is the backhaul networks, and it's the phone companies. And it is a problem. I mean, they don't believe in Moore's Law. They want prices to go up. And so I think in this country, we're going to have a serious problem imagining the future because of our bandwidth problems and our connectivity issues. Going and making it so your little device can be online all the time. Are you going to use Wi-Fi or a cell modem thing? It's expensive and clunky. Other countries don't have this problem. So thank God, maybe this country will outgrow our phone company. Well, man, they just became a monopoly again. Well, anyway, other than that, I think most of the things are on the curve that you're talking about.
We do work all over the world in mobile technologies, and it's so ironic coming back to the U.S. and feeling, okay, I'm home. Now I'm back in the dark ages of mobile phones after seeing what everybody in Europe and Asia is doing.
I think for Surface, I mean, we're doing research on watching these cost curves. And I think that's why we felt like it was really important to go into these environments like leisure, entertainment, and retail, where there was a really clear value proposition of, you know, differentiating based on enhanced consumer experiences in those environments. And but the other thing that it allowed was to really get it out into the world and not have the end user paying the price tag for it, but just being able to be exposed to the unique attributes of this new Surface platform. And so that's kind of how we have thought about our go-to-market strategy, really, is to give people the experience and really learn from that. What do they care about? What's not so important? And then, you know, just keep tracking with getting it down to a price where people could really afford it in their homes day to day. Well, it depends. Like, we're working with a subset of partners right now, but depending on what aspects of the technology they want, somewhere between $5,000 and $10,000.
I think what Kristen's getting at is that by having the business strategy, having a tiered rollout with different targets as you roll it out, that you are gradually increasing the number of units that get built and pushing the cost down so that when you ultimately get to consumers, it's a much lower price point and a lot more affordable, and giving some thought to how do you get from here to there, right? You don't just go straight to consumers and say, hey, here's a cool $10,000 product. You look at some B2B plays or some other ways, you can get it out there, get people to see what it is and start increasing the volume so you can drive costs down.
And, you know, on that point, Lee, that the gaming space is something where that does happen because of the volume of people that play games, you're able to drive the costs down. And the technology is not quite there yet, but I've seen technologies and I've played with technologies, we're experimenting with them, where you will have a 3D camera. And I've actually played with software where it's like Minority Report. You've got pictures on the screen and you move this way, you move your hand this way, and you can move things around, you can rotate them, just like Surface, but in 3D. And these types of technologies can detect full 3D motion and acceleration just by a camera. So, you know, if I move my hand 2 inches forward, it can detect that. If I move it 2 inches back, if I move it faster, it can detect that. If I move it very slow, it can detect that. And the technologies, again, aren't quite on the market yet. But when you look at a gaming application and the types of volumes that we can do, a product like that on the market, which can run on a gaming console, anywhere between $200 to $300 for a gaming console, a product like that will probably be on the market within the next 2 years for less than $100. Now, it depends on the software and how you utilize that and take advantage of that. But, you know, the hardware costs certainly are getting much lower.
So with the drop of cost, that makes these technologies very disposable for people in our income bracket. But there's also just sort of problems with being in a disposable culture where everything is thrown away in a 2 to 3 year cycle. I was wondering if the panel could speak a little bit about building technologies that are more resilient or upgradable.
Anybody?
It's obviously a huge problem and something we're going to have to get much better at. In the European Union, particularly in Germany, companies have cradle-to-grave responsibility for all the stuff they make. And I think that's been faster to be adopted in Europe than here because space is more constrained and people sort of have to live with their trash heaps, if you will. Here in the U.S., we are pretty behind the curve on kind of cradle-to-grave responsibility. We export a lot of our tech trash to the developing world. Interestingly, I think National Geographic just had an interesting article on where your tech stuff goes, and it's, you know, hugely disconcerting. I think that that's something that we're going to have to move to, particularly because some of the components of computing are fairly toxic, so that we're going to have to take more responsibility for the stuff we make and start thinking about responsibility.
Great. I was wondering if you could speak to any research that you've done or that you've seen regarding how these technologies have opened up more practice in the other demographics, such as seniors or very, very young children.
Well, from a gaming perspective, you know, I wouldn't say it's specific research, but anecdotal things that we've seen. A platform like Nintendo Wii, which completely changed the way people are playing games, right? From sit down with the controller in your hand for 5 hours until your hand cramps up and you can't move it anymore to, you know, stand up with a very simple sort of wand type controller. And they're actually being bought up. A lot of these Wiis are being bought up by senior homes where they can get seniors up off the couch or wheelchair, you know, whatever it is. And people are using it to become more active. And it's fun, right? It's entertaining. So it's much more interesting to play, bowling for 5 minutes on the Wii, you know, than it is to think about having to do, you know, some other more strenuous activity. So we're definitely seeing that happen with products like Nintendo and what they're doing. There's a product that Nintendo also makes, and they're definitely on the forefront, called Brain Age, which, if you guys have heard about that, it's a game, you know, if you could call it a game, it literally, they call it, you know, train your brain in minutes a day. And in Japan and in the US, there are also seniors who are buying this, where you literally, you're doing simple things like adding and multiplying and subtracting and matching colors. But the concept behind the game is that it improves your mental process and your thinking process so that, you know, you can stay sharp. So we're definitely seeing gaming technologies being applied to demographics outside of, you know, your traditional gamers.
Well, and Lee, Eric Dishman, a friend of yours from Intel, he's leading a big charge on that too, right?
Yeah, Intel is doing a huge initiative to make computing more easy for elders and particularly people that are losing cognitive functioning, particularly people with Alzheimer's. So looking at some interfaces where computing can help people as they start to lose brain functions as they age. And I think there's tremendous opportunity for computing interfaces in that regard. I'd also argue that Nokia and other cell phone makers are already learning a lot about using iconography and design as they design products for markets like China and India, where you can't assume that people are necessarily literate or even speaking all the same language. I forget how many languages are spoken in India or China, but it's a bunch. And so you have to get design really easy to use for people so that they can understand how things work.
I can just speak to the child thing. It always fascinates me to understand how complex the technology is for Surface. And adults are somewhat impressed, but when kids walk up and use it, they're like, well, yeah, this is the way things should have always been. So they're not very impressed because they, you know, that's the world that they see. But I always find it funny because the designers are expecting them to be like, wow, you know, but they walk up and use it. And what's the big deal? Yeah. So.
Yeah. Now, I just want to say I'm a huge fan of the Surface computing device. I've been able to play with it at Microsoft's Global Tech.
Can you speak into the mic, please?
I was saying that I'm a huge fan of the Surface computing model, and been able to play with the device at one of the Microsoft events. But it's going to be a while before that's mainstream technology. And my question is, it seems to me that one of the easy ways, for us to start bridging the gap between where we are now to there is just to hide some of the options in a user interface that people don't use. Mm-hmm. So you talked about you pay for actually having less features. Well, why aren't companies, looking at the user interface and saying, hey, let's have the users choose which features they want on the main interface? Why isn't that happening now?
Well, it is actually, as we're partnering with specific, our partners are Starwood Hotels and Harrah's and T-Mobile and IGT, which is a casino company. And the kinds of experiences that consumers want to have, although it's, leisure, entertainment, and retail, they're different kinds of experiences. And so our partners are working with an SDK and their ISVs to actually make applications that make sense in those environments. And so they are customizing for their different environments. So I think it is happening because consumers want different experiences in their different venues. So
that might work. But when we've seen configurability and websites and the like, people just don't do it. It's a good way to sort of get to satisfy the very particular people to make it configurable. But by and large, people use it kind of as is. So maybe people that are repackaging and thinking it through for a broader audience, but when they're just thinking it through them for themselves, at least we've found in our website development, people just don't. They use it kind of as is, and if it's not good enough, well, goodbye.
Okay. Did you have a last?
No, I think it's very similar. You as an interface designer, and what we do with our games, you do try to hide as much as possible. At the same time, though, just by offering some of those features, people see them and they kind of wonder what it is, and it automatically starts to feel more complex. So there's a real fine balance, and it's a real tough challenge to figure out how much to take away and how much to leave. But again, what we try to do is try to simplify as much as possible.
All right, last question. And I'm just looking for a number. So this is called Kill Your Mouse. We're looking for the year prediction that you think the mouse will be absolutely, totally, completely dead. Wait.
I don't think there is one. I don't think that technologies go away. I just think they can become repurposed and become niches that you can't necessarily predict. You can still buy a 78 RPM record.
Kristen.
I agree with Lee, actually. I think that the keyboard and mouse are great for particular kinds of tasks, and I think they'll remain prevalent as far out as I can see.
Brewster.
If you take the trackpad as a replacement for the mouse, I think the mouse is already dead. I can't think of the last time I actually used one of these. But it's interesting that I think you'd probably think, oh, well, that's still a mouse. So I'd say it's 2004.
Guy.
Wow, we've got two nevers and one in the past.
It's up to you.
We left it wide open for you, Guy.
In the future, right? All right. I got to take a stand. I'm going to say 2046.
All right.
And the reason I say that is because we're seeing some new technologies where, like Emotive, where you can literally think about things and you've got this headset and they can happen. And whether you would still maybe call that a mouse or not, maybe it's the the child of the mouse. You know, I don't know, but definitely I think new technologies are probably going to replace them.
Please thank everybody on our panel. Thank you very much. Lee Shu, Kristen Alexander, Brewster Kahle, and Kai Wong.